Margaret Thatcher's memoir, Return to Moscow, 16th of March, 1985. On Monday's early morning news, BBC, I heard that military music was being broadcast in Moscow and that the previous night's broadcasting had closed down without giving details of programmes for the following day. Most unusual. We had had military music before, but not the other thing. A few days previously, Mr. Chernenko had been made to appear on television at some event to reassure the people. He looked ghastly, his actions were mechanical, and watching, one felt that he was scarcely there. We had not long to wait. I was chairing a meeting in the cabinet room when at about 11 a.m. the news came through that Mr. Chernenko had died. Shortly afterwards, that Mr. Gorbachev had been put in charge of the funeral preparations. So it seemed that he had been appointed leader, for following Mr. Andropov's death, Mr. Chernenko had similarly been in charge of the funeral. Before the day was out, Mr. G's appointment as Secretary General was confirmed and the funeral fixed for Wednesday. Very soon telephone calls were coming in from opposition parties to say they would like to come on the plane. We decided that we could just complete questions on Tuesday afternoon and still get to Moscow in respectable time. I took questions in a very businesslike fashion, giving short replies. Indeed, we got through a record number of supplementaries, 18 in 15 minutes. We made a dash for Wellington Barracks, where a helicopter was waiting to take us to Heathrow. The Russian ambassador was there to see us off. We greeted the New Zealand High Commissioner, who was coming with us to represent his government in Moscow. On the plane, I read and analysed Mr. Gorbachev's acceptance speech. No deviation from settled policies, but more initiative needed, their fundamental dilemma, and also a speech he had recently made at Kiev. All confirmed the impression gained at Chequers the previous December, that even if he wished to change matters, he wouldn't know how to, because a rigid communist system was the only one he had ever known. We landed in Moscow at 10:30 p.m. and were met by a deputy foreign minister, a battery of cameras and a fleet of cars. They gave me a very large one, and as the ambassador climbed in beside me, I signalled to him, circling my hand in the air. Was the car likely to be bugged? He nodded, and the conversation proceeded carefully. It is a long journey into Moscow along a very straight road. There was still a lot of snow, and it had got very dirty. There were not many lights in the shops as we went down Gorky Street, but then there aren't that number of shops, even though it is the main shopping centre. We all poured into the residence where miraculously the staff, even at that short notice, had everything prepared. With secretaries and security, we were quite a crowd. As on a previous occasion, I had taken over masses of fresh vegetables and fruit and English cheese, because that is what they wanted most. The residence is sited perfectly, opposite the Kremlin, on the other side of the river. It is a magnificent house, built by a sugar baron who married into the aristocracy and built a suitable house for such a bride. The story goes that the architect asked him what style he preferred. Something of everything, came the reply. And so some in Flemish, some German, some French, some Italian, but all lavish and large and superb craftsmanship. The bedroom I have has an enormous bathroom dressing room, all panelled heavily in dark wood, and partitioned heavily into bathroom area, toilet in a large square cubicle, massive linen cupboard, and another shallow cupboard that opens out into mirrors. Funerals are great occasions for meeting other heads of government, and two or three interviews had already been arranged for the morrow. Because I had to get back on Wednesday night, we had been given a slot at 7:15 p.m. with Mr. G. Our first duty on Wednesday was to go to the lying in state and lay a wreath. The procedure is quite different from any I have known elsewhere. Two soldiers preceded us, each carrying a wreath, the first from H.M. the Queen and the other from me. The queues of people waiting to pay their respects are stopped as visiting politicians go into the main room. There the body, fully embalmed, is surrounded by banked flowers. Music is playing quietly, and the two soldiers just stand holding the wreath while the ambassador and I face the embalmed figure, standing quietly for a moment or two. As the protocol officer comes forward, we bow to the open coffin and then go to see the family who are sitting at the side of the room, some in tears and all deeply grieved. It is really a terrible ordeal for them. Mrs. Chernenko is such a nice woman, I shook hands with her and she pointed to her neighbour, who was crying, saying in English, his sister and then daughters. Even the head of a communist country who has no sympathy for those who disagree nevertheless has a family who sorrow for him. Slowly we left the room and passed the waiting queue. Shortly after, President Zia arrived at our embassy and we talked of the problems of the Afghanistan refugees, of the increased numbers of Soviet soldiers, up to 150,000 in that country, in a ruthless effort to put down all opposition. But of course they will not succeed. So long as the resistance can obtain supplies of food and equipment, they will go on resisting. The official ceremony did not begin until 1 p.m, but we had to leave at 12:15 to take up our appointed places. There is a large space allocated for heads of government immediately to the left of Lenin's tomb as you face it. It is carpeted, but there are no chairs. We stand. Some snow had fallen overnight, so everywhere looked nice and clean. The skies were grey. It was several degrees below freezing and felt very raw. I do not possess a fur coat, so made myself as warm as possible in a wool coat and fur-lined boots. In my pockets I carry warm packs, which help a little. Our cars park inside the Kremlin, and we walk through the Kremlin gate to the Red Square to take up our position. I recalled the previous occasion when we had come to Mr. Andropov's funeral. As I had passed through the gate, I saw Mrs. Gandhi, and we walked together to our places. Alas, neither of us could have foreseen that she would no longer be with us because of the assassin's bullet. The first person I saw was Mr. Perez de Cuellar, SG of UN, and I had a quick word with him about the Cyprus talks which were being reconvened under his auspices. President Kyprianou had been to see me, and I had urged him to accept the SG's documents. Mr. Willock, the Norwegian PM, was standing close by and said he was disappointed that we had not proceeded to buy Sleipner gas. I moved forward, spoke to President Manana of Zimbabwe, and found myself in the front row by the side of the Moroccan delegation, PM and Foreign Minister, who congratulated me warmly on the end of the miners' strike. I was astonished how much they knew about it. We still had about 35 minutes to wait, and it was cold, very cold. Soon President Mitterrand and Mr. Dumas came to join us. We could see George Bush and Chancellor Kohl in the crowd, President Koivisto of Finland, several others we knew and many we didn't. On the pavement in front of us stood a line of Russian army officers, spaced about 6 or 7 feet apart. They looked very fine young men, superbly tailored grey greatcoats, white gloves, black boots, grey fur hats. They didn't move a muscle. They were relieved by a new guard just before the ceremony began. Facing us, the other side of the road, was the band flanked by rows of well-ordered people. All men, as far as I could see, with many in uniform scattered among them. There were banners of Mr. Chernenko at frequent intervals. Otherwise, there were no crowds, just everyone standing silently in his appointed place, in heavy anoraks, all in fur hats. Just before 1 p.m, the band began to play a funeral dirge. The Politburo and a few others appeared on the balcony as the gun carriage and escort came into view. The lid of the coffin, all covered in gathered red silk, was removed and the coffin itself placed on the catafalque, facing and tilted towards the balcony. At the same time, a dozen or so officers, each carrying a medal on a scarlet cushion, moved to flank the catafalque. Two others held a large portrait of Mr. Chernenko. The family, some 30 or so, moved into position facing the balcony, and I was thankful to see that chairs were brought for the ladies to sit on. When I first attended a communist funeral, Tito's, it had been a shock to realise that it contained no religious element whatsoever. Of course, one knew that intellectually, but just a final political ceremony? It seemed comfortless and matter-of-fact. Mr. Chernenko's funeral had a let's-get-over-it conveyor quality about it, except for the family for whom the ceremonial may have been some comfort. The speeches began. The voice and command of Mr. Gorbachev in such striking contrast with the hesitancy and muffed words of Mr. Chernenko's a year previously at Mr. Andropov's funeral. There were four other speeches, one from a member of the Politburo, another from someone in agriculture, a third from the Academy of Sciences, and a fourth representing the Komsomol. We all turned and faced the balcony as we listened, uncomprehending of the actual words, but catching something of the personality and demeanour of each speaker. On the previous occasion, Mr. Andropov's funeral, I had been struck by the oratory of Mr. Gromyko, a lovely speaking voice and a natural air of authority. We had never seen him quite like that before. This time he did not speak, but stood next to Mr. Gorbachev, still an obviously influential figure. The speeches took half an hour or so. Then the coffin was moved to the space behind the building for the interment, which we could not see. The band played the same dirge over and over again, finishing with the anthem as the Politburo reappeared on the balcony. Then, the funeral over, the mood changed sharply as the band struck up for the march past, and very impressive it is, all officers marching in goose step, which we hate because of its connections, but which they still adopt. Each row matched perfectly in height. The guard in front of us, on the pavement, was augmented for the march past. And then it was all over, save for filing past the grave. We moved slowly round from our enclosure, seeing and talking to other colleagues, our friends from Holland, the Deputy Prime Minister and Mr. Van den Broek, relieved that we could move at last and get the blood circulating. A pause, a bow to the grave, then back in a long winding file into the Kremlin and towards St. George's Hall for the reception. President Pertini of Italy was just ahead of us, looking very frail, and supported by two others as he walked slowly in the bitter cold. St. George's Hall is unbelievably beautiful. Lofty, all in white, with the most magnificent chandeliers dominated by hundreds of electric candlelights marching in continuous line just below the cornice. And not a single bulb had gone. Every one was working. The file climbed slowly up the long staircase, passing a rather wonderful picture of Lenin addressing a youth congress at the top. Before we got to that point, the protocol officer had come to me, as on a previous occasion at Mr. Andropov's funeral, and said, "Ladies first. Come along, Mrs. T, we must move you forward." Madame Marcos and her delegation he also picked out. So we queue-jumped right into St. George's Hall, feeling a little guilty, for we British don't like queue-jumping. We all shook hands with the reception party. Mr. Gorbachev, the Prime Minister, and Mr. Gromyko. Once again he expressed appreciation that I had come. Clearly they were pleased as they had been a year earlier. Knowing I was to see Mr. Gorbachev later, I confined my words to condolence and congratulation, for the waiting queue was long. Then we crossed the room, all on a way well indicated by red carpet, bow to a portrait of Mr. Chernenko, the final farewell, past the press, and out again. In the queue we greeted George Bush and George Shultz and Chancellor Kohl, all still with a way to go. We saw and had a word with Armand Hammer and returned quickly to the embassy for lunch. It was now about 2:40 p.m. and we were cold and hungry.